draw near.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. First case this morning is Garth versus Davis. Mr. Kobe.
May it please the court. This court should reverse the judgment of the district court as petitioner has not shown that he is entitled to relief on his jury instruction claim, no matter what context in which it is raised. First, the freestanding claim of trial court error instructing the jury on attempted murder is barred from review by procedural default. Here, the adequate and independent state law ground relied upon the state courts is waiver for failure to object to the instruction at trial.
But don't we have a problem here? Because the Indiana Supreme Court first recognized that its accomplice liability statute requires a showing of specific intent after Mr. Garth's trial and appeal. So, I mean, why shouldn't he be entitled to present this argument for the first time still in post-conviction proceedings?
Because Bethel v. State, which was the Indiana Supreme Court decision that recognized that the rule that accomplice liability for attempted murder required specific intent was not a new statement of the law. It was a statement of the law as it has always been, and just simply followed Spradlin v. State, which had already applied specific intent to attempted murder. So this wasn't a new rule, and the Indiana Supreme Court has repeatedly stated that this is what the law has always been. This was just simply the first case that explicitly recognized it as such. There was no case law before that saying that specific intent wasn't required. It had just simply not been raised as an issue up till that point. So it wasn't a new rule of criminal law. It was simply a statement of what the law has always been. Petitioner further compounded his waiver by failing to present fundamental error as an exception to the waiver rule, much like cause and prejudice is an exception to procedural default, during his direct appeal. And so that's where the failure to present the claim as fundamental error is further unavailable to petitioner on post-conviction, because the only context within which he can raise fundamental error under Indiana law is on direct appeal. Regardless of procedural default, this claim is without merit, and it's without merit when we look at the what the error was and the prejudice to defend it, not only as a freestanding claim, but it also shows no prejudice under either ineffective assistance of trial counsel or ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. Here, the only problem with the aiding instruction was not that the instruction itself was incorrect. It was a correct statement of law and correctly applied to the robbery charge, which petitioner was also charged with here. He was charged both as a principal in the robbery and as an accomplice to the robbery. The only thing that the aiding instruction lacked was an amount of specificity towards the attempted murder.
Well, the focus of the trial was on the question of aiding and abetting. And the post-conviction court conceded that the instruction on aiding and abetting was, on aiding and inducing was incorrect. And is it, in your view, is it really possible that any other instruction can undo the damage done when the primary jury instruction is flawed?
First of all, the main focus of the trial was not intent. The main focus of the trial and the defendant's trial was that no attempted murder happened at all.
The focus of the trial was on whether Garth aided the person who was holding the gun. And it was clear at the trial that he was not the one holding the gun to the victim's head.
Correct. But his defense was that no one held a gun to the victim's head. Not that his accomplice didn't, but that no one. There was no attempted murder here. And in fact, Garth had changed his story from a previous trial.
Let's zero in on this incorrect jury instruction.
The jury was instructed in the instruction laying out the elements for attempted murder that Garth had to act with the specific intent to kill Hardy at the time of the crime, at the time of the act, the gun held to Hardy's head.
Well, acting with specific intent to commit murder, to it, knowingly killing James Hardy.
Correct. The murder, knowingly to kill James Hardy, is defining what murder is. Murder is the knowing killing of James Hardy.
Yeah, you know, in the brief, you claim that the instruction could be read to say acting with specific intent to knowingly kill James Hardy. How can we have any faith that a jury knew what to do with that?
The jury was also told not only in that instruction, but in the court's final instruction number 5, that attempt is a crime of specific intent, that you have to specifically intend the result. So for him to aid murder, he had to specifically intend that the murder happened, that the killing happened. Those two elements, those two instructions, define for the jury what the elements of attempted murder are. The accomplice liability instruction, describing what it is to knowingly aid or abet, simply supplemented those, but did not take away from the jury was instructed on those elements.
Well,
this is what the Indiana Court of Appeals found.
Look, at the very least, these instructions are confusing as the mens rea requirement. And, I have to tell you, they certainly were confusing to me. So, maybe not to my brothers, but certainly to me. And they do indeed seem to instruct that Garth could be convicted if his behavior was knowing rather than intentional. And this is a trial that's wholly about mens rea.
I would respectfully disagree about that. The trial was not about mens rea. The trial was about whether an attempted murder occurred.
Well, the only thing separating the defense's theory from the state's, the only thing that separates innocence from guilt here is the distinction between knowledge and specific intent.
I would disagree on the attempted murder charge because Garth was not asking the jury, saying, I took part in the robbery, but I didn't know anything about the attempted murder. That was wholly my brother's idea. If I would have known about it, I wouldn't have participated in the robbery. What Garth's story was, we committed the robbery, but there was no attempted murder. My brother never held the gun to Mr. Hardy's head. That's a total fabrication by Mr. Hardy. And this actually was after Garth had already admitted that he had lied at a previous trial. So the jury was faced with Garth's story, which he had admitted was new, a new version of events that was different from his past testimony, and Hardy's testimony, the victim. It's not reasonable that the jury, had they had this extra information in this jury instruction, would have credited Garth's testimony any differently than it did. The jury still would have credited Hardy's testimony, discredited Garth's testimony as not gelling with the facts and being a recent fabrication, and still found him guilty. In addition to his story of events, the other evidence that points to the jury wouldn't have been any effect on the jury by this additional language is these men were known to the clerk. He knew them on site, yet they went in to rob without any masks on. The reasonable inference from that is that they planned on leaving no survivors, that the intent from the beginning was to kill the clerk during the robbery, so he could not identify them.
Do you have any law on that point?
It would seem to me just to be a factual inference from the facts of the case. we can look to see whether what they intended by their actions, and their actions by robbing the clerk that knew them and could easily identify them after the robbery if they did not kill him, doesn't make sense. Quickly to touch on ineffective assistance of counsel, both trial counsel and appellate counsel, petitioner fails under both prongs, both of the Strickland prongs, both performance and prejudice. I've already explained why there's no reasonable probability of an effect on the jury. Performance here was also not deficient. Counsel's theory, and the defendant's theory, was that no attempted murder occurred, and so he was gearing the defense towards that. The instructions, as they were stated, were a correct statement of law. The aiding instructions simply lacked some specificity. And had counsel tendered an instruction, it wouldn't have affected his theory of the case, because his theory was no attempted murder happened. So counsel was performed reasonably by not focusing his effort on that, especially when it was unclear he didn't have specific precedent to support that extra language. So counsel was reasonable in choosing different battles. Appellate counsel was not ineffective for raising this issue. Appellate counsel raised several issues that were preserved by the record, and had he prevailed on the insufficient evidence claim, petitioner would have been let go and unable to be retried under double jeopardy. So those issues that counsel did raise were certainly of the same caliber as this claim. Because the district court erred in granting judgment in this case, as the jury instruction claim error by petitioner can not prevail under any context in which it is raised, we ask this court to reverse the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Matthew Burke, and I represent Petitioner Faraji Garth. Under Indiana law, one cannot be guilty of attempted murder as an accomplice unless they act not merely with knowledge, but with specific intent that the killing occur.
The state's not contesting that, are they?
But, Your Honor, it's critical to the point that the jury instructions in this case denied my client the due process of law because they repeatedly told the jurors that they could convict my client if he had acted with knowledge. Moreover, the instructions were not harmless because...
Well, the instructions 2, 5, and the first instruction all describe specific intent, don't they?
Your Honor, I don't have the number of...
Well, all right. The definition of murder requires specific intent. That's number 2. The number 5, specific intent is material element of the crime charged, and then the additional one, the culpability type, is specific intent required with every material element.
Well, let me address the last of those first. I believe that the third instruction that you referred to also says that that instruction applies unless otherwise provided by the statute defining the offense. Now, the jurors in this case were not given the statute defining the offense, but they were given jury instructions, and they were told that those jury instructions defined the offense, and those jury instructions provided otherwise. There are 3 instructions given in this case that all bore specifically on the issue of accomplice liability. And each of the instructions on accomplice liability told the jury 2 things, and 2 things very clearly. First, it told the jury that an accomplice does not need to commit each element of an offense if the accomplice acts in concert with another. And so that instruction told the jurors that the remainder of the instructions might not apply as when it came to accomplice liability. Moreover, there was another instruction that said that one who acts in concert with another, quote, is liable criminally for everything done by his confederates, which flows incidentally from the execution of the common design as the natural and probable consequences of the common design. That's not even a knowledge instruction, Your Honor. That's a recklessness instruction, much less specific intent. Moreover, the accomplice liability instruction itself said a person who knowingly or intentionally aids, induces, or causes another person to commit an offense commits that offense, then to aid under the law is to knowingly aid. It is knowingly doing some act to render aid to the actual perpetrator of the crime, although without taking a direct share in its commission. So the three instructions that were specifically on the issue of accomplice liability told the jurors, look, you don't need to consider all the general principles of criminal liability when it comes to accomplices.
Well, how about the instruction number two, which says to convict the defendant, Garth, in count one, the state must have proved each of the following elements. The defendant, on or about August 21, 1987, acting with specific intent to commit murder, to it during the killing James Hardy.
Well, Your Honor, as I pointed out in my brief, that instruction could not possibly have cured the error here, because that instruction defines specific intent to mean knowledge. And so one instruction that wrongly designates a specific intent crime as a knowing crime can't be cured by a second instruction that defines specific intent to mean knowledge. Now, the state court's adjudication of this claim was unreasonable because it simply chose to ignore the second half of that sentence. And it can't be reasonable for the state court to just pick and choose which portions of an instruction it wants to read in order to come up with a way to affirm someone's conviction. The Supreme Court has been clear, you have to read the instructions as a whole in the context of the trial record when deciding whether or not there is a reasonable likelihood that a jury would convict, that a jury would read the instructions as relieving the state of its burden of proof. Moreover, that instruction number two, defining attempted murder, also said that a person commits murder when, acting with the culpability required for the commission of murder, they take a substantial step towards the commission of murder. And then the very preceding sentence defines the culpability required for the commission of murder as knowingly or intentionally. And so these instructions, time and time again, told the jurors, knowledge would suffice. Knowledge would suffice. And although there were some instructions on general principles of criminal liability, those instructions said that they only apply unless the statute defining the offense provided otherwise. And so those general instructions on the issue of criminal liability couldn't possibly trump the far more specific instructions that all were on accomplice liability, especially when you consider that the accomplice liability instructions themselves said, look, you don't have to commit any element of the offense. The other instructions about general principles of criminal liability don't necessarily apply when you're talking about accomplices. So, Your Honor, I think there's only one possible reasonable interpretation of these instructions, and that is that an accomplice can be convicted if they act knowingly. Moreover, I don't need to prove that it's the best reading. I don't need to prove by a preponderance of the evidence. Boyd versus California made that clear. All I need to show is that there is a reasonable likelihood that the jury would read these instructions as a whole in the context of the trial record as relieving the state of its burden. And I think that that is here easily. At best, what you have is a contradiction. I don't even think you have a contradiction, because I think the more specific instructions trump the more general instructions, especially given that the more specific instructions say they trump the more general instructions. But let's assume that we have a contradiction. The Supreme Court in Francis versus Franklin said, when you have two contradictory instructions and you do not have a third instruction that explains that contradiction, as a matter of law, you have a reasonable likelihood that the jury would have read the instructions as relieving the state of its burden. The state court's adjudication of this claim was both contrary to and an unreasonable application of Supreme Court precedent. It was contrary to because it did not apply the Roy versus California reasonable likelihood test, and it was unreasonable because its reading of the set of the instructions was simply implausible. Now, respondent argues in his reply brief that the Boyd versus California test does not apply here, and that the Boyd versus California test is limited to capital cases raising Eighth Amendment claims. That's simply not true. The Supreme Court has gone out of its way to explain that the Boyd test applies across the board, and the Supreme Court itself, in Estelle versus McGuire, applied the Boyd versus California test to a non-capital case that raised only a due process claim. So the Boyd versus California test applies here. Now, I'd like to back up for just a moment, Your Honors, and address the adequate and independent state ground doctrine. There is no adequate and independent state ground in this case, because the waiver rule applied by the post-conviction court here is not not apply even-handedly to all similar claims. The Indiana courts have gone out of their way to say that a claim based on case law that comes out after your direct appeal is the paradigmatic case of a claim that may be brought for the first instance during post-conviction proceedings. And so if the Indiana courts had been applying the rules as they are ordinarily applied, they would have allowed Mr. Gluck to bring his claim for the first instance during post-conviction proceedings. Now, respondent cited several cases in his brief for the proposition that a jury instruction accomplice liability claim may be waived even though it's based on case law that comes down after your direct appeal. Now, even among the cases cited by respondent in his brief, there is inconsistency. Some of those cases hold the claim waived. One of them holds that it's not waived.
You're talking about Eddington, Hooker, and Cowherd?
That's correct, Your Honor. But let's assume that all the cases cited by respondent in his brief all went the same way. That still does not establish that there's an even-handedly applied rule, because none of those cases give any meaningful explanation about why an accomplice liability jury instruction claim should be subject to any different waiving rule than the wide variety of claims that the Indiana courts routinely allow to be brought for the first instance during post-conviction proceedings. And so all the respondent has established by citing those cases is that there is inconsistency in the application of this rule. And that merely proves my point, that there is no adequate state law ground. And let's assume again that there is an adequate state law ground now. There certainly was not a firmly established rule as of the time of the acts or omissions that are claimed to worth the forfeiture in this case. The acts or omissions claimed to worth the forfeiture in this case were trial counsel's failure to object a trial and counsel's failure to raise a similar argument on appeal. Mr. Gluck's direct appeal was resolved in 1999. All of the cases cited by respondent in his brief date from 2002 or later. And finally, if the respondent is correct that Gluck waived his claim at trial and on appeal, that means trial and appellate counsel were ineffective. Respondent can't have it both ways. Either the claim was available or the claim was not available. If it was available and counsel failed to raise it then, counsel was ineffective. If the claim was not available, there can't be any waiver and there's no procedural default. Either way, the court should affirm. And I think the only remaining issue in this case is whether the error was harmless. Now, first and foremost, Your Honor, the respondent did not argue below that this error was harmless. And so any argument on that point has been forfeited. And despite the fact that I pointed this out in my brief, respondent's reply brief does not make any attempt to explain why the harmlessness argument has not been forfeited. So it's been doubly forfeited. But let's assume that the court chooses to reach that issue. It's also important to note that the state court did not address the harmless error inquiry. So this court has to address the harmlessness error inquiry, if at all, de novo. The harmless error inquiry asks whether there was a substantial influence in determining the jury's verdict. It does not ask whether there was sufficient evidence to convict absent the failures affected by the error. And it is clear that the instructions in this case create at least a substantial influence in determining the jury's verdict. Respondent argues that my client did not contest his intent at trial. He did contest his intent at trial. It was the primary issue contested at trial. During the opening statement, counsel said, quote, "It's going to be impossible and that you can come up with anything short of a reasonable doubt as to my client's participation in this." At the close of the prosecution's case in chief, defense counsel moved for a direct verdict, arguing that there had been a total lack of evidence that he had the intent, the requisite intent required by the statute, unquote. There are pages and pages of trial transcripts dedicated to disputing nothing but whether or not my client was ever in the back room, whether or not my client could hear what was going on, whether he could see what was going on, whether my client physically attacked the victim. All of these issues go solely to the question of intent. None of them had anything to do with whether or not the gunman tried to fire the gun. None of these pieces of evidence make it any more or any less likely that the gunman tried to fire the gun. So the primary issue was whether my client contested his intent. And because intent was the primary issue...
There wasn't an issue of whether or not the gun was fired?
Well, my client, as the respondent points out, my client also did testify my brother didn't attempt to kill that man. But I think that statement has to be read in context. My client's testimony was that He was never in the back room. And so my client, a witness, can only testify about those things that they had personal knowledge of. And so my client's testimony that my brother wasn't in the back room has to be that my brother didn't attempt to kill that man. That can only be evidence for the proposition that I never saw my brother kill that man. So there was never any competent evidence offered to contradict whether or not there was an attempt. But let's assume that the attempt element was also contested. A defendant is entitled to argue the alternative. A defendant is entitled to hold the state to its burden of proof on each and every element of an offense. So that my client may have also contested whether there was an attempt, in no way undermines that the primary issue was his intent. And because the primary issue was his intent, a jury instruction that misdefines mens rea was absolutely catastrophic.
So if we look at the transcript in detail, we'll find that most of it, that the examination with regard to this issue was the major portion of the defense.
Absolutely, absolutely. You will find, I'm not sure how many pages, but you will find many, many pages where defense counsel is disputing the size of the back room. And his purpose for that was in demonstrating that, look, there's no way that four grown men could all have been back in this tiny little storage area at the same time. And if my client wasn't in the back room, well, my client, the case that my client acted with specific intent is much, much weaker. Especially, and so it's abundantly clear that these instructions were harmful, because the only difference between the prosecution's theory of the case and the defense's theory of the case was the difference between specific intent and knowledge. And the jury instructions told the jurors that either one would do, that no matter whose theory was correct, that no matter who you believe, no matter which inferences you draw, that Mr. Garza acted with knowledge, and that under these instructions, you should convict him. That's the functional equivalent of a directed verdict. That is not the due process of law. That is not a harmless error. And this court should affirm. If there are any more questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I don't believe so. Thank you, Mr. Berg. Toby, how much time? You have 3 minutes, Mr. Coley.
Just a few brief points. Instructions 11, 12, and 14, the general instructions on accomplice liability, we're talking about acts of co-defendants, co-perpetrators, could be imputed to the defendant. It says nothing about intent. It says nothing about intent can be imputed. It's clear that those instructions are only about acts done by your co-perpetrator in the furtherance of the crime can be imputed to you. Boyd v. California is the wrong standard to apply here. That case is only applicable when you have an instruction that may be a mandatory or permissive presumption. And when you're looking at that, it's clear, Seventh Circuit, this court has held in Cain v. McBride, that you look at the instructions as a whole to see whether the jury was sufficiently informed of the elements of the crime. And here they were, and that's exactly what the Indiana Court of Appeals found. The cases cited that apply Bethel, in my brief that applied Bethel, are post 2000 cases, 2002 cases, because Bethel was decided in 2000. So cases couldn't before that say that Bethel is not new law because Bethel hadn't been decided yet. And the Indiana courts have consistently applied the rule that if new case law comes out, that is not a new rule of criminal law, it's simply an exposition on the current law, those claims are not available on post-conviction as fundamental error. I would ask this court simply to look at closing argument of counsel to see what the defense theory was of this case. Defense counsel spent the whole time of trial trying to challenge the victim's account in this case, Hardy, whether he heard clicks, whether the lights were on, whether they were off, how many people were there. He was going towards that no attempted murder happened, that Hardy was perhaps making this up, going farther than actually what the individuals that came in to rob him did. We would ask this court to reverse the judgment of the district.
Mr. Colby, your opponent says that the undersigned counsel has not identified any basis for retrying Garth on the robbery conviction.
The
that your view as well?
Correct.
We're only talking about, the only matter at issue here is the attempted murder.
The attempted murder. And as a factual matter, Garth has served his sentence for the robbery conviction, and he's now serving the consecutive sentence on his attempted murder.
But they were run concurrently. Okay. Just 45 years.
But because there's nothing left on his robbery conviction, he's been in jail longer than his robbery conviction, so there can't be anything added on. He's only serving attempted murder now.
And it was a day? Good time, is that why?
Yes. I'm not sure his complete sentence has been served. Good time, what status he's been.
I'm talking about the 15 years he received for the robbery.
Yeah, I assume in order for him to have served his full term, he would have had to get some good time credit. Whether he lost any credit, I'm not aware of that. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks to both counsel. Mr. Burke, you accepted this case. On behalf of the court, we thank you very much for your vigorous representation. Thank you. Next case this morning.